Welcome to the podcast of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta, where we are committed to changing lives with faith, hope, and love. We're so glad you are here.
Hi, and welcome to the final installment of Sunday Seminary Online for the spring of 2020. We started at the beginning of this academic year, way back in September, by talking about the intertestamental period, the period between the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament, and the New Testament. We have shifted a bit into the New Testament, and we have shifted a bit in terms of our content and our format by shifting into the online mode because of COVID-19, of course. If you want to continue the study of the Bible over the summer, I'm going to be leading a Bible study on the book of Job. It'll meet Sundays at 9:30 in the morning on Facebook. There's like a Facebook group that you'll be able to join. It's called Office Hours. There'll be some more information in the Marietta newsletter and emails, blasts, and things like that if you're interested. But we will start the Sunday after Memorial Day. So that's May 31st will be the first day of the study. So please join us there. Email me if you want some more information about that. And I look forward to engaging with you all in a different online format until the time when we can meet again in person, which I hope comes soon and very soon. Speaking of soon and very soon, we're going to talk about the Revelation to John today and close out the Bible with the last book in the Bible, that is the Apocalypse. So let's dive in a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about apocalyptic literature itself, and then we'll shift into talking about the book of Revelation in particular. So along with my course that I was teaching at Columbia Theological Seminary, I recorded a little video called The Introduction to Apocalyptic Literature. So I'm going to throw it to myself. I'm going to cut to a part of the video that I already recorded for my class, the Introduction to the Old Testament class, where I talked about Daniel 7 to 12. Now, the thing is, there's only really two full-blown apocalypses in the Bible. The first would be Daniel chapters 7 through 12. So Daniel chapters 1 through 6 are not apocalyptic. Daniel chapters 1 through 6 are kind of like folk tales about people caught in the midst of complicated situations during the time of the exile and after what we would call the diaspora. So it's kind of like a how to survive in the midst of a foreign empire literature. Then we can shift a bit to the second half of Daniel, chapter 7 through 12, and you can see that there's this big change. There's a change in terms of the content and how it's told and so on. Daniel chapter 7 through 12 are where you'll find the stuff about the beasts coming out of the sea. It's where you'll find the stuff about the ram, like with the giant horn that like is crushing another ram, and it symbolizes an empire. It's where you'll find the stuff about the Son of Man coming with the clouds and so on. It's where you'll find the stuff about resurrection, all the crazy 70 weeks of years kinds of things, those predictions of the end. All that stuff is found in the second half of the book of Daniel. And that is the apocalyptic part. The book of Revelation, or the Revelation of John, or the Apocalypse, or the Apocalypse of John, all those things refer to the same book, that last book of the New Testament. That is the other really full-blown apocalypse in the Bible. So this is a genre of literature, a kind of literature, apocalyptic literature. And just like we would say that like the genre of fairy tales operates according to its own kind of logic, like there's a kind of rules to how fairy tales work as stories. And if you're familiar with how fairy tales work, the kind of world that they presume, then you're going to be able to understand them a lot better. So if you imagine a space alien being told a fairy tale, they might not get that this isn't set in a particular time and place. It's kind of a la-la land, that there's supposed to be a moral at the end of the story, that kids are supposed to be put in crazy danger and then make their way out of it. That's what a fairy tale is all about, right? Like Hansel and Gretel kind of stuff. Well, if you didn't know all that, you might be really confused by fairy tales as a genre or a type of literature. So in the same way, apocalypses function a certain way, and they don't function like a gospel. A gospel is like a theological biography of someone, and we can say that the letters or the epistles, like the letters of Paul, that follows a particular genre or style of literature, the Greco-Roman letter, right, which we tried to point out, follows very particular structures and so on. And this is a revelation, an apocalypse. The word revelation comes from this word actually in chapter 1, verse 1, the description in Revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. he made it known by sending his angel to the servant, to his servant John. So John is identified as this person who receives a revelation or an unveiling, and that's that word apocalypsis or apocalypto. This is a Greek word which means like an unveiling or a revelation, a revealing. So that genre of literature, apocalypse, a revelation is written in a time when people were familiar, at least people in this culture, that is Judaism and Jewish followers of Jesus and other Gentiles who were involved in that movement. Those folks understood apocalypses. So what is an apocalypse? I'm going to throw it to myself, and I'll pick back up here in a minute. By the way, you'll notice I'm wearing a hoodie in this next clip, and that's because it was the last day of class. I was taking it casual there, so sorry. Last Sunday Seminary Online of the year, I will also be casual. See you in a minute. All right, so apocalyptic literature. This is so crucial to understand Christianity, to understand the history of apocalyptic literature, because Christianity is an apocalyptic group. Paul is an apocalyptic Jew. Jesus is an apocalyptic Jew. All early Christians would have been understood as apocalyptic members of Judaism, of the religion of Judaism. So another thing is like the Dead Sea Scroll sect, or the people that John the Baptist hung out with. The Essenes might be the term for these folks. These are all apocalyptic Jews. Apocalyptic thought emerges within Judaism, and within about a century, it has influenced Greek thought. It's influenced really Egyptian thought. There's Egyptian apocalypses from near this time. It's influenced Persian thought. It influences Mesopotamian thought. Apocalypses start to emerge, but really, historically, we think these begin within Judaism, and they begin sometime in the 3rd century BC. What is apocalyptic literature? Okay, first of all, when people say, hey, that's apocalyptic, they may not be talking about the same thing that we're talking about here in the Bible with biblical apocalypses. Apocalyptic literature is a genre, kind of like lament poetry, right? Or ancestor stories in Genesis, right? So apocalyptic literature is a type of literature. It follows a particular kind of set of rules almost for creating that literature. Just like with a fairy tale, once upon a time, it's got to be set in a land far away, it's got to have some little kids in danger, right? It's got to have a nice moral at the end of the story and a happy ending, right? Those are the rules for the genre of a fairy tale. Apocalyptic literature has its own rules. Today, people use the word apocalyptic to mean kind of like, I don't know, massive, major, an end, terrible, right? It can be used to mean all kinds of things. And we can even talk about apocalyptic mindsets or apocalyptic views. People who are like prepping for the end, for society to fall apart might be said to have apocalyptic ideas today. Those ideas, I think, in a way, come from apocalyptic literature. But so we're going to talk about the very specific forms of biblical apocalyptic literature that we find only fully formed in Daniel chapters 7 through 12. And in Revelation. There's lots of other apocalyptic literature from ancient Judaism and from early Christians that we can point to, and I'll point to a couple of these works later on. But to say that the only two that made it in the Bible were some of these chapters in Daniel and Revelation. You'll talk about Revelation in the New Testament class, but this will form a foundation. It's the same genre. Revelation is building upon some of the insights from Daniel. So here we have, by the way, John of Patmos, a medieval tapestry of the angel coming to John. So there's some features of apocalyptic literature. Just like I said, for a fairy tale, like it's assumed that there's a parent talking to a child, that it's a story about children in danger, and there's a happy ending and a moral. So in the same way, here's the features, the major features of apocalyptic literature. Not apocryphal. That's the hidden books or whatever, the JV canon. But in any event, apocalyptic literature is pseudepigraphal, almost all of it. What that means is that there's an author named who's not necessarily the author. This is not just true for Daniel, where the works ascribed to Daniel in chapters 7 through 12 definitely reflect the time of basically what we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes, the time of the Greek kingdoms dominating Jerusalem, and especially this moment of crisis that begins in the year 167 BC. So it's not written by Daniel. Sorry. But this is a part of a larger genre. There's a book that's just about written at the same time as the book of Daniel, especially chapters 7 through 12, and that's the book of Enoch. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but you know, Enoch is the guy from Genesis who's said to be taken up into heaven without dying. I mean, at least that's what it maybe says. It's actually a really, really strange bit of text. But we'll put that aside, all to say that later folks, Jews, right about the time of Daniel chapter 7 through 12, when that was written, they were reading this book of Enoch and they were thinking, wow, that's some pretty cool stuff. That's really interesting. There's some interesting questions brought up by the fact that Enoch didn't die. There was a book written that ended up being called First Enoch, that is scripture still in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, but is I think not included as Christian scripture in any other living Christian group. And while it was very popular with Jewish authors, it fell out of favor with the rabbis, and so was not included in the Jewish canon. It's quoted in Jude, the book of Jude, that little tiny book. You don't ever say chapter to Jude because it's so short, right? But that actually has a reference to First Enoch in it. And Jesus may have a couple of references to First Enoch in his literature. All to say, this was a really popular book at the time of Jesus and understood to be, at least in some ways, sacred. So in any event, it's not written by Enoch. Definitely not written by Enoch. It's written by people writing in Enoch's name. And this wasn't taken to be a lie, or this is before the time of, before the ideas of like plagiarism. This is before the printing press. This is before the idea of academic credit for your work. So it wasn't considered evil to claim, or like trickery to try to claim someone else's name. It was writing through the experiences of someone else that you learned about through a text or something like that. So all to say, apocalyptic literature tends to be written in someone's name. It also always has a human recipient. That is, it's kind of a human gets this kind of a message of some kind, and that message is given by or interpreted by an angel, a messenger from God. Another important thing about apocalyptic literature is that it focuses a lot on angels. Have you noticed throughout the Old Testament that there's not a whole lot of detail when it comes to explanations or descriptions of angels? They're just people, or maybe there's even some ambiguity, like the three visitors in Genesis 18 that come to Abraham and Sarah. Like, they just show up out of nowhere, and then, like, one of them happens to be God, or all three God. I mean, there's, you know, Christian readings of this, making them three parts of the Trinity, but then it's like they speak as I, and then the two of them just kind of vanish, and one of them is, like, talking to Abram and, like, haggling over what to do with Sodom and Gomorrah. All to say that that story is really complex and complicated because angels are demoted in terms of how much interest is put into them by ancient Israelite authors, precisely because they wanted to not make you think about other divine beings. They wanted you to focus on one divine being, God, because they were trying to move in a way towards what we might call henotheism or monotheism, right? They didn't want you to worship other gods, other deities. And if you thought something was an angel in the ancient world outside of Israel, you would worship it. You would sacrifice to it because it's a divine being. It requires your honor and your attention. That's what sacrifice is. Ancient Israelite authors don't want you to sacrifice to angels, so they don't want you to think about them much. So they make them just kind of extensions of God's presence, and that's it. They don't name them. They call them angels or messengers, which demotes them in terms of their stature or status. Think of them as like minor divine beings, but also demons. They don't want you to think much about demons because they don't want you to worship them. They don't want you to sacrifice to them, which is what everyone did in the ancient world. So they just demote opinion about them, right, or interest in them. By the time Jews are talking in terms of apocalyptic literature, by about the year 200 BC, there is a lot of interest in divine beings, in angels and in demons at this point in time, in part because they've gotten a basic idea of monotheism, and now they can start to kind of focus on some of those other questions that we might have about, like, where is evil come from? Where might we find evil in the world? Is it just confined to human hearts? And that's a question that Jews begin to address sometime around the year 300, between 300 and 200 BC, in a more careful way. We could also say this about angels. Angels start to get names for the first time ever sometime between the year 300 and 200 BC. Two of the first named angels are Michael and Gabriel, which we only find named in Daniel chapters 7 through 12. We find both of them there. That's the only part of the Old Testament you'll find a named angel. Sometimes you'll see an angel called the angel of the Lord, but that's it. I mean, that could be anybody, right? So, that could be any of the angels, assumed to be lots of them. There's a host of them, right? So by the New Testament, you can still get Michael and Gabriel, but you don't get much more interest in naming lots more of them. That comes somewhat later in Christian history to kind of name lots of the other angels. Eastern Orthodox theology does this quite a lot. But all to say that there's this the idea that angels have to explain this information to you. If you think about the book of Amos, right? Amos had things revealed to him, but he understood what they were. Like Amos understood that an end was coming, and that end was that Jerusalem was going to get destroyed. I mean, remember God says to Amos, here's a basket of summer fruit. And Amos is like, cool. Oh no, an end is coming, right? It was a play on that word, kayats and cates for summer fruit and end. Amos gets what's going to happen. In Daniel chapter 7 through 12, Daniel doesn't get it at all. It's a mystery to him, even once it's revealed, like what's going to happen. These beasts come out of the ocean in Daniel 7. He's like, I don't get it. I need help. So an angel has to explain this stuff every single chapter to Daniel. The same thing happens in the book of Revelation. And this is unusual in terms of the prophecy we see in the Old Testament, right? So the idea that this is there's a human recipient receiving this information or seeing things that needs to be interpreted or mediated in some way by an angel. That's foundational to apocalyptic literature and found nowhere else in the Old Testament, really. And the content of this stuff is usually a revelation. Sometimes it's about space. In First Enoch, it's like a tour of the heavens, and part of it is about time. In the stuff that made it into the Bible, Daniel 7 through 12, and Revelation, it's really about less about space and it's more about time. So in biblical apocalyptic literature, it's about a revelation of the future. And it's usually understood to be kind of near future. It has to do with kind of in Daniel, it's about like a few years, which we'll see. But it's this revelation of something that's going to happen in the future. And this is foundational to that word apocalyptic. So apocalyptic comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, which means an unveiling or some sort of revealing. The idea there is that we are all walking around through our lives and looking at the world and thinking we see things how they really are, but we don't. We're looking through a veil, and we need to be kind of like unveiled or revealed, right? That's what apocalyptic means. Like if you took off some sort of like mask, and saw the world, then that would be the unveiling, the apocalypsis. There's a couple people recently who have written, so Catherine Keller wrote an article in some newspaper recently. She's a theologian at Drew University up in New Jersey, and she wrote an article about how like what we're going through with COVID is in some way a revealing or an unveiling of like where our priorities really are. I mean, it's been obvious to a lot of people for a long time that a lot of our priorities in the United States are fairly cruel, but what's happening with COVID actually unveils or reveals some of this stuff. So in some way, it's kind of a revealing of how things really are. In Revelation, it's about the Roman Empire, and in Daniel 7 through 12, it's about what they're going through in a certain moment in Jewish history that I'll explain in a moment. So another element of apocalyptic literature is a periodization of time. Time is kind of divided into chunks that may not seem self-evident. And what it really is all about is kind of a telling of the story of history again. The next element there, ex eventu prophecy, that means prophecy after it's happened. What this means is that in apocalyptic literature, what you get is like usually this like story that goes way back in history. And like almost all of history is narrated in this one story that like goes in a way that you wouldn't expect. The reason is this. Jews living in the land of Israel during the period of the Persian period, but also later in the time of the Greek kingdoms and the Roman Empire, they were living under the boot of an empire that was telling them how the world was, right? They were telling them what history was, where their place in history was, and of course for the Jews, their place was nowhere in history, right? Revelatory stuff in apocalyptic literature retells all of history so that you can see everything in a different way. Think about it like this. If your story has been told to you by other people who have been telling you your own story for the purposes of trying to subjugate you, then what you might really need is not just someone telling you that's fake, but you might need a new story, a different story, right? To convince yourself that that's not true, what you've been told about yourself your whole life. So the ancient Jews were apocalyptic literature was written for them for the purposes of retelling their history so that they could be finally freed from some of the things that they had been convinced of by these dominant empires about God. Is God sovereign or not? How could your God possibly be important? Because the Babylonians dominated you. The Persians dominated you. The Greeks are dominating you. Where's your God? God. Your God is pathetic, right? If you want to see where God is active in history, maybe it's got to be somewhat narrated somewhat differently. Now, remember our last class, we talked about the Persian period and this notion that God seemed more remote or removed in the theology of the Persian period, a hidden or distant God. This is one way of re-understanding the story of God's dominance or sovereignty, control of the world. In spite of people telling you, hey, we dominated you, so that means your God stinks. Instead, you might say, actually, I do think God is at work here. Remember Daniel, in Daniel chapters 1 through 6, God let Jerusalem fall into Nebuchadnezzar's hands for the purpose of spreading the message of Yahweh abroad. Right? That's a very different way of thinking about God's sovereignty than like what the Greeks would be telling you about what that meant about your defeat, right? So apocalyptic literature develops this idea and deepens it and broadens it by retelling all of history. So this periodization of time, you can think about this like the four kingdoms, right? First, there was the Babylonians, and then there was the Medes, and then there was the Persians, and then there was the Greeks, and then there was the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Yahweh. That's a retelling of history that upends the way that empires talk about themselves. Putting it into like, there was this empire, then there was this empire, then there was this empire. That shows you that empires only exist for a certain amount of time. And then somehow, kind of miraculously or strangely, they disappear, even though they seemed so strong. It might suggest divine intervention, right? So all to say that this kind of retelling of history is for the purposes of organizing the people and reorganizing the way that they think about themselves. And this ex eventu means after the fact. What this means is that the prophecy usually kind of starts way back in history and goes up to a certain point near the point at which the apocalypse was written. And then there's like this kind of brief intermission and switch to the present day. And then a brief step into the future. So for the book of Daniel, as we'll see, this has to do with basically like between the years 167 and 164 BC. It's like a 3-year period where there was a real question about what was going on. But in order to help them figure out what was going on there, they went way back into history and retold history up to that point. So next, the way that history is usually told through apocalypses is that since the beginning of time, there's been this massive struggle between good and evil. And what people might call this is a dualistic way of seeing the universe, or a theological dualism. So dualism means there's two sides, good and bad, God's side and the devil's side. You'll notice that in the Old Testament up to this point, there hasn't really been this dualistic way of seeing the world, right? There's a refrain in the Old Testament that like the Lord heals, but the Lord wounds, but the Lord binds up. All right, the Lord strikes down and the Lord raises up. You know, Yahweh does all these things. Think about the book of Job, right? Where do all the bad things come from? Satan, right? No, not actually. In the book of Job, the bad things come from God. Yahweh admits that Yahweh did all that bad stuff. The book of Job is not about the devil versus God. The book of Job is about how do we deal with being a monotheistic people and having one God be responsible for all the bad crap that happens in our life. And if we want to say that God is good, what happens? Like, you know, how do we deal with that? That's the question of the book of Job. Apocalyptic literature presents us with a change, a shift. Something happened that was so intense, so strange, so difficult to understand as an act of God that Jews ended up rethinking their theology of evil. The book of Leviticus says, instead of sacrificing to ward off demons, which is what everyone did in the ancient world, that's why you sacrifice, try to use the blood to get rid of demons or evil spirits. Instead, Leviticus says, you're going to claim that lamb or whatever you're bringing to sacrifice as your own to get rid of your sins, right? Don't blame your sins on demons. Take responsibility for them and try to make up for them yourself, right? That's the theology of Leviticus. But what if that doesn't work one day? What if something happens that's so bad, so intense, so bizarre, so inexplicable that we can't say that God did it? I mean, like the fall of Jerusalem was horrific. And Jews still said at the time, like Jeremiah says, hey, God did this. Yahweh did this. And there's something that we did that played into this. And we can get out of it some way. I mean, that was their message. But something had to be even worse than the fall of Jerusalem to break that theology of Yahweh's responsibility over the entire earth, and to make Jews have to go and rethink their theology of evil. And this is what we're going to talk about today. What was it that caused that break and caused a revisiting and a rewriting of the theology of evil to include something like a cosmic evil that's beyond the evil that's kind of summed up in all human hearts? Something else out there, but it's not Yahweh either. So, in any event, good versus evil and dualism. I should say, by the way, that this apocalyptic literature can be abused in some pretty serious ways, right, by Christians. Apocalyptic literature was generally written by people who had been subjugated in the ancient world. When it's taken over as a theology of conquerors, as a theology of people who think of themselves as being strong and who possess power and the power to subjugate others, this dualistic theology can be incredibly harmful, and it can come to terrible ends. So the American church, for one, needs to think really carefully about the way that we use apocalypse in apocalyptic literature, apocalyptic themes, dualism, to not make us the good guys, right? And using that term to refer to like the way that the U.S. tends to talk about its military military adventures right around the globe. I think here of the time that a biblical scholar that I know, Thomas Romer, got a phone call from the president of France, Jacques Chirac, who himself had at the time gotten a phone call from the then president, George W. Bush, who said that he was going to explain the book of Ezekiel, the Gog and Magog stuff from Ezekiel 38 and 39, to the president of France to try to convince him to go to war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And the biblical scholar was like, I don't think that's referring to Saddam Hussein, right? But all to say that this stuff can lead to wars and domination, at least attempts at domination by powerful people. So we need to watch out for some of this theology. At the same time, this good versus evil dualism stuff is really has proven throughout history to be incredibly helpful to communities that are under attack, that are minority cultures under assault. The idea that, like, hey, the world is at least from one perspective simple. There is some evil in the world, and there's some good in the world, and good eventually will overcome evil. That seems to be the main message of apocalyptic literature. And for the purpose of telling people, and I'll skip to the very last one here, hold on to the end. That's a major part of apocalyptic literature. You got to hold on to the end. Stay fast in your faith. Don't give up now. God is going to help us. And even though it seems like God is being overwhelmed, we're being overwhelmed, God will be with us. Hold on to the end. Stay faithful. That's the main message of apocalypse. It's really encouraging message to those suffering persecution. That's the idea, at least. That the second to last thing, their numbers, codes, and myths. The way it's expressed is generally through these bizarre seeming kind of stories with really bright, almost like a shocking stories sometimes violence, of bizarre things like dragons and sea monsters and, composite beasts that roam the land and get in fights. And, you read Daniel chapter 7 and you think, what is this stuff, right? There's also lots of mentions of numbers like 1,250 mornings and evenings a time, times, and half a time, right? These kind of strange numbers and secret codes that you have to read, like 666 in Revelation, right? All of these things are part of this apocalyptic genre. In part, some people have said maybe this is to kind of escape detection from a major empire. I think more so it's to try to help us see that there's different reasons for different parts of this, that the codes and secret codes sometimes is to tell us that it's really hard sometimes to see the truth of the world. That the truth of the world sometimes is hidden. It's a mystery, and it needs to be unveiled for us or revealed for us. I think that's part of why those images exist. They also captivate us, right? And some people have also pointed out that some of the things like snakes and dragons and women clothed in the sun, that stuff in part, it it speaks to us in a symbolic language that has to do with the symbols that existed at the time in the ancient world. A bit like a political cartoon. If you see a donkey and an elephant talking to each other, you know what's happening. It's about the Republicans and the Democrats. But 200 years from now, someone might say, what the heck is this stuff, right? What are these donkeys and elephants talking to each other? So it might be kind of political cartoons of the ancient world. The Assyrian Empire talked about itself as a lion a lot. So did the Babylonians. So you see lions show up here, and maybe it's saying something about the power, the images of power, or the tree in Daniel 4 that grows up and covers over the whole earth. The tree of life is a major symbol for Mesopotamia. So all to say, so a lot of these probably connect to imagery that was used by kings and by empires in the ancient world. A lot of the imagery in Revelation has to do with the Roman Empire. So apocalyptic imagery really is anti-imperial. It's trying to convince people that love God, that love Yahweh, that God will be with you, and that all of these things that try to convince you, the propaganda that you're getting from the empire that's trying to convince you that it's useless to fight back, you need to submit to the empire, there's no hope for you, there's no hope for your God, that you can, there's enough clues in the world for you to see beyond what looks to be plain truth and see that there's a deeper hidden truth that underlies all of that. There's a deeper force, a deeper power operating in history. And that's God. So in any event, this is, you know, the basic genre, the basic outline of apocalyptic literature. We could say, you know, where does this stuff come from? It comes from the Jews. I mean, it becomes hugely powerful and popular throughout the ancient world, even just a couple centuries after it was created. But it comes from Jews. And it probably draws out of some of the prophetic imagery that you can see throughout the Old Testament. So things like Ezekiel 40 through 48, where Ezekiel is taken in the spirit and is shown a vision of what's about to happen in a rebuilt, a kind of reconstituted Jerusalem. Some of the imagery that we see in Zechariah chapters 9 through 14, which is what we might call proto-apocalypse, or Isaiah chapters 24 through 27, where there's like this strange vision of the end of the world, it seems, kind of, where there's some sort of massive battle and heroes are risen up out of their graves and they share a feast and death itself is defeated. This is, you know, testifying to Yahweh's power to overcome even death itself, which is this kind of moving towards apocalyptic literature. The book of Joel is associated with kind of this movement from prophecy towards apocalyptic literature, where Joel has, you know, is talking about visions and of the end. There's the locust kind of vision, but then there's also visions of people having kind of an overflow of the spirit and the power, being filled with the power of the spirit, but also this kind of terrible judgment at the end. So we can see that there's a movement here. It's also influenced by probably the Judaism's encounter with Persian religion, Zoroastrianism. The ancient religion of Persia was a dualistic religion. There was a good god, Ahura Mazda, and a bad god, and they fought against each other. Except that they were like equally matched. In Judaism, of course, Yahweh is more powerful, but there's still this kind of notion. Jews would have encountered during the time of Persian domination the idea that maybe there is an evil power that's not Yahweh in the world. There's also other historical influences that we can see throughout time and space that build up to this, but those are the two main influences, it seems. One other thing to talk about is that prophetic literature and apocalyptic literature both talk about the end. Eschatology is the big theological word that means the end, study of the end. When we talk about like the, you know, like Christology means the study of Jesus, basically like, is Jesus fully God or fully human or both? You know, that's Christology. How does that work? Eschatology is the study of the end. We can say that there's a couple different kinds of eschatology here. Oops, I gotta move my face, my big old face here. Okay. Not now, iCloud. Okay, so there's a couple different kinds of eschatology that we can see in the Old Testament. One is prophetic eschatology. What do the prophets have to say about the end? So prophets, like Amos, said there was an end coming. But they didn't mean the end, right? They meant an end to our country, our king, this kingdom, right? This nation. But it will go on. We will go on. Faith in God will go on. That's not an end to the world. It's just the end of something now. So, you know, the prophecy that Solomon's kingdom is going to get broken up, well, you know, that's the end of that kingdom, or at least part of it. But it's not the end of all time. apocalyptic eschatology, which only emerges sometime in the Greek period, the Hellenistic period, that is the end, like the real end. And it's, again, it's not the total end of everything. It's not that, it's not like the universe ends and there's nothing. It's that there is an end after which there's a radical break in time and space. There's going to be a judgment usually is associated with this. There's a resurrection that is the, usually the idea is that people come back. As we'll see in Daniel, maybe the same kind of resurrection that Jesus talks about, but there's a resurrection. This kind of arise in the idea that God will reward some and punish others. That is the idea is that the things that the justice that wasn't taken care of on this earth will be taken care of then. Again, that idea can be abused in Jewish and Christian theology, but for those who have suffered through great abuse and injustice and who die without seeing any movement of justice, perhaps this idea that God somehow is going to take account of that in the end, that may have been very powerful, and I think it is really powerful. So in any event, that's the difference between prophetic eschatology, like an end to the nation, and apocalyptic eschatology, the end. Okay, like I said, Jewish apocalypses it was a popular genre starting in sometime around the year 250 or so BC, continuing until the time of Jesus and beyond. So here's some popular Jewish apocalypses from near the time, like, you know, from starting a bit, sometime around the year 250 all the way to the, I mean, the, people make these today, kind of biblical sounding apocalypses, but they were a popular genre all the way up through the Middle Ages. But so the First Enoch is a book that again is a scripture for the Ethiopian Orthodox community, Christian community, and it is the first parts of it started to be written sometime around the year 250 BC. Second Baruch is another Jewish apocalyptic text. Fourth Ezra, sometimes also called Second Esdras, this is a beautiful text. It's in here, in your HarperCollins Study Bible, and it was written by Jews after the year 70 AD, after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and which was, as you might imagine, the second temple being destroyed. I mean, this was a traumatic event, and so it's dealing with the trauma of the loss of the temple, and it's a dialogue. There's an angelic mediator who's trying to explain why this might have happened. It's in part a theodicy. Theodicy means asking the question of, like, why did this bad thing happen if there's a good God? Fourth Ezra might be one that, you know, over the summer, just, you know, bookmark that one and come back to it. It's got some beautiful theology in it. There's also some other apocalypses that end up in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Apocalypse of Moses and the Apocalypse of Metatron, which sounds a little bit like a, I don't know, like an action figure or something, something that comes from a Marvel movie, but it's not. It's an ancient angel, and it's sometimes called Third Enoch, and you can just Google Third Enoch or Apocalypse of Metatron, and you can read that online. The Qumran War Scroll, that was from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scroll community was an apocalyptic community which saw the division between good and evil and the end was going to come. It's very likely that John the Baptist comes from a community that was associated with the Dead Sea Scroll community, or at least some larger group that both of those entities were associated with. John the Baptist is talking about light and dark and good and evil and baptizing people, which they did in a way at the Dead Sea Scroll community to try to get out the evil spirits and stuff. I mean, this is, you know, we're kind of moving along the way to what the New Testament assumes is kind of normative for Judaism at the time. Which, again, if you read the Old Testament, you just won't see a lot of these things. You know, another question is, like, where do the Pharisees come from? You don't read about them in the Old Testament, or the Sadducees, and, you know, all that stuff. All that emerges seemingly out of nowhere because if you're just reading the Bible, because we're missing some of that intervening literature. But Daniel 7 through 12 is one of the few things that kind of bridges that gap a bit. All right, well, thanks, Brennan, for that wonderful description of apocalyptic literature. So I hope that clears things up a little bit about apocalyptic, but we'll get into the very specific example of Revelation right now. So the book of Revelation, or the Revelation to John, or the Apocalypse of John, all those are appropriate and fine for the book. There was no title really given to it in antiquity other than the Revelation of Jesus Christ, which God, you know, the kind of beginning of the book was taken to be the title here. One thing it's not is Revelations. I don't know why somehow in popular literature and culture it gets pluralized. You know, it's revelations everywhere, but it's not the Book of Revelations. Just to make that clear. So the Book of Revelation, right over here, we have a Papyrus 47, which is a very early papyrus manuscript of the Book of Revelation here, and you can see the Greek. The handwriting there. The Book of Revelation, there's an argument a bit about its dating, but very few people would date it much earlier than 100 CE right now, or sometime around the years, let's say 90 to 120 or something. It's pretty much the pretty common way to date the Book of Revelation. It used to be that people would put it back in the 60s or 50s, even under the time of Nero. Nero is mentioned in the Book of Revelation, but as I'll point out in just a minute, Nero's mentioned in conjunction with a myth that Nero was going to come back from the dead, which was a myth that seems to have arisen sometime around the year 100, or maybe just before it. But also, the kind of persecution that's mentioned in Revelation doesn't seem to have been endemic in any place outside of Rome after the time of Nero until about the year 100. So, as we can see from the Book of Revelation, I'll get to this in a minute, it's set really in Asia Minor, or what we would call today the area around what's modern-day Turkey. So that was a Greek area, a Greek-speaking area, an area dominated by the Roman Empire at the time. That had all these churches that are kind of the seven churches of Revelation, right? But also places that Paul, for the most part, hung out and founded a lot of these communities, places like Ephesus that Paul spent a lot of time walking around. And visiting. So these were well-known places in this Asia Minor, this community of churches in Asia Minor. What was I saying? So the area around Asia Minor, the area around what's modern-day Turkey, was an area that had intense persecution, at least in several specific places and specific times, sometime around the year 100, probably around the reign of the Emperor Domitian. This is not, as many people understand it, a kind of widespread persecution, like every Christian was being crucified or burned or thrown to the animals and so on. The persecution under Nero was very specific. Nero blamed Christians and probably Jews with the fire that devastated a section of downtown Rome, kind of a tenement area. Nero really said it himself because he wanted to make it into his lovely palace, the Domus Aurea, which you can actually go visit in Rome. It's been open in the last decade or so. But in any event, you know, you can go visit that area that Nero repurposed. Nero seems to have blamed Christians on it. It might have burned Christians in retaliation for it, kind of public retaliation. So that was a very specific event and a specific kind of brutality in the city of Rome. Revelation doesn't seem to be set in Rome, so the brutality from Nero against people in Rome probably wasn't the cause for this book. But there does seem to be something about the Roman Empire, and there does seem to be something about persecution, and there does seem to be kind of the situation in Asia Minor. That would suggest to us the persecutions that happened in Asia Minor sometime around the year 100 CE that were not perhaps sponsored by Domitian, the Emperor Domitian, but that somehow took place under his reign. So, again, the churches in Asia Minor, the seven churches of Revelation, so Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Smyrna, Ephesus, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, or Laodicea. These are well-known cities. You can go on tours, you know, of the seven cities in Revelation and so on. Well, I guess not right now, but you know, later on you can go. They're beautiful places, but some of them actually are not fully excavated and things yet, which is kind of amazing. I don't think Laodicea is actually fully excavated yet, and Colossa nearby is not either. So anyway, all to say there's some work to be done on some of these locations. Whoever it was who wrote this book seems to have been familiar with these areas and knew them very well. So history would tell us, the Christian tradition would tell us a particular story about who wrote this book and why. The story that Christian tradition hands down is that it's John the Apostle, also the person who wrote the Gospel of John, also associated with the three letters of John, the Johannine literature. So in kind of earlier centuries of scholarly analysis, the Johannine literature encompassed all of those different books, and recently people have pointed out that Revelation is pretty different from the Gospel of John and the three letters of John. The Gospel of John and the three letters of John seem to be written in a very similar style. There are some differences that are interesting to look at, but as I pointed out earlier, the Gospel of John never says anywhere in it, "I'm John, I wrote the Gospel." And the beloved disciple is not actually named as the author, and the beloved disciple is not named. That is, it's an anonymous kind of character in the story, perhaps put there for you to imagine yourself in the story. So all to say, like, maybe it's actually not a good thing that we're assuming it's John. But anyway, the name John is not found in the Gospel of John as an author's name. The author's name is found in Revelation, but it's not named as John the Apostle. It's named as John the servant of God. Maybe you'd say, well, of course that's John the prophet. Well, John is a very common name at this point in time, in this time in history. Yohanan. It'd be like saying, you know, John today. You know, well, of course it's John, the same John, right? You know, how do we know that it's the same John, right? What this person seems to be is a prophet, a self-styled prophet. What's really interesting about the book of Revelation is that it suggests to us a community that is kind of based on the person of the prophet. Other literature in the New Testament talks about things like bishops and deacons and teachers, right? You can think about like Paul's orderly kind of structure of the church, and then what's continued in the Deutero Pauline literature, or the kind of post-Paul literature that's associated with Paul, that organizes the structures of the church even more. What we see in Revelation is really different. The word apostle is mentioned a couple times in the book of Revelation, but it's not really clear what it means. Most of those times that it's mentioned, it's actually referring to people who are bad, like people who pretend to be apostles. And the apostles are actually looked back on at the very end of Revelation as something long ago. Also, the words like teacher, preacher, deacon, bishop, those things are not mentioned in Revelation. Those things are also not mentioned in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John, I think, only says apostle once. And the letters of John are also kind of bereft of these things. So it's really interesting that this might be suggestive of a different form of Christianity with a different kind of institutional structure that existed that really talks about saints a lot. I know Paul uses that word too, but here in Revelation and in the Gospel of John and in the letters of John, it does seem like that's kind of it's a really important theme or motif, the idea of saints. So there's prophets and there's saints, and that's pretty much it in the church. So all to say, we might be looking at, many recent scholars have said that Revelation is very different from the letters of John and the Gospel of John. So a lot of people are willing to put the letters of John and the Gospel of John in kind of a bucket together and say, this is Johannine Christianity. I agree with some scholars, like Luke Timothy Johnson is a recent scholar who points this out, that Revelation does seem to have some similarities with these other books, including this kind of different form of institutional Christianity, but also really like interesting motifs like the lamb, like saying that Jesus is the lamb. Now that's used in other gospels, but it's the centerpiece of the Gospel of John. That's why John disagrees with all the other gospels and says that Jesus was killed, was crucified on the day before Passover, when the Passover lamb was sacrificed. John is also the only gospel to say that Jesus' bones didn't get broken. That's because it goes against Jewish regulations to break the bones of the Passover lamb. All to say, like, you know, John is setting up Jesus is the Passover lamb. And then, of course, the revelation of John talks a lot about this Passover, about the lamb who was slain. That's another big motif in the book of Revelation. And there's lots of other things, too, like the way that light is used and water is used. Anyway, all to say, there's lots of resonances between Revelation and the Gospel of John and the three letters of John. Now, why would I say it's different then? Well, it's different because Revelation is written in a kind of Greek that is almost unreadable. It is unbelievable how different it is than the Gospel of John in terms of the level of Greek. It is written clearly by someone for whom Hebrew or Aramaic is their first language. It's definitely written by someone who either doesn't have the same access to scholarly Greek and scholarly Greek education that other people have, other people who are responsible for much of the rest of the literature in the New Testament, or perhaps it's written in this kind of intentionally strange style. That's what some people hold. I think probably it's just someone who isn't very good at writing Greek, but I might be wrong. Whoever wrote it, though, it's not that they're not smart. They are brilliant. They are really, really interesting thinkers and writers, and the way it's structured is really amazing. The kind of circular structure of Revelation is really interesting and very literary, and also these really dense allusions to the Old Testament, what would have been to them the Scriptures. Betrays someone with a lot of education and a lot of memorization of what we think of as the Old Testament. So I think this is a highly educated person, someone who probably mostly writes in Aramaic, and there were different kinds of scribes who wrote in different languages and in different scripts and so on. So I'm wondering if this might have been kind of poorly translated into Greek, or perhaps someone wrote in bad Greek as like a kind of like a hey, that'll show you to the empire, right? Writing kind of in the language of the empire poorly. Now, you might say, well, Latin's the language of the Roman Empire, right? Well, not in Asia Minor. If you think about like the Byzantine Empire, like the Greek Roman Empire, right? They continued, Constantinople, they continued to call themselves the Roman Empire until 1453 because they were the Roman Empire. They were the eastern half of the Roman Empire. And they spoke Greek there. They always spoke Greek there. Like the Greek Orthodox Church. That's really the kind of Eastern Roman Orthodox Church. So the Eastern Roman Empire always spoke Greek as opposed to Latin and wrote mainly in Greek as opposed to Latin. You can find Latin inscriptions everywhere here, but the day-to-day stuff was carried out in Greek. So all to say, this was the language of empire in Asia Minor. And Revelation seems to be a book that's very anxious about fighting against the empire. It wants you to position yourself as being opposed to Roman rule. Now, think for a second about like Paul's letters, where Paul says, like in Romans 13, yeah, get along with the Romans, right? Get along with the Roman Empire. And the letters of Peter, 1 Peter, says, you know, be a servant of the Roman Empire, you know? I mean, it's not saying do things that would go contrary to your Christian faith just to fit in the Roman Empire. They don't say that. They say carve out spaces to make yourself kind of a follower of Jesus and don't do the things you're not supposed to do. At the same time, anything that they tell you to do that is fine to do, yeah, do it. This looks a little bit more like Daniel chapters 1 through 6, where Daniel's trying to like accommodate the empire. He learns the language of the Babylonians and so on and works for the king, but at the same time carves out little spaces like his food in Daniel chapter 1, right? He refuses the food from the king's table. There's like little spaces that they carve out for themselves. That looks a lot like what Paul is talking about, for the most part, and what Peter is talking about in 1 Peter. The book of Revelation is very different in the sense that it seems to hate the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is an enemy. The point of the book is to try to get you to see that the Roman Empire is opposed to God, is opposed to Jesus. So this is partly why we would say that this guy John, who gives letters of prophecy in the first few chapters, right, chapters 1 through 3, John receives a revelation, and so it is an apocalypse, but at the same time, he kind of preaches prophetically at these seven churches, and he tells them, you know, here's what you should do and shouldn't do. This goes along with the Old Testament prophets, who mainly weren't telling these about things like thousands of years in the future. The prophets of the Old Testament were mainly confronting people, right, saying here's what you should do and here's what you shouldn't do based on God's law. And that seems to be a lot like what the early chapters of Revelation are all about. And then also this like prediction, the rest of the book of Revelation, after chapter 3, that eventually God's justice is going to win out and that God will triumph over evil. Now this sounds a lot like the Old Testament prophets too, because you think about like the book of Amos, right? Amos is saying to the people of the northern kingdom of Israel, you're acting as bad as Pharaoh, when Pharaoh was oppressing the Hebrew slaves, and God gave Pharaoh a chance to give up the slaves, and he refused to, so God knocked Pharaoh down and freed the slaves, right? So that's one story, right, of kind of the empire or the dominant kingdom getting thrown down in order to create justice on earth. The book of Revelation is a lot like that, right? That there's these martyrs who are bleeding. You know, the blood of the martyrs is like crying out for justice. And that's a big part of the book of Revelation here. So all to say that kind of prophecy and the prophetic background, John really styles himself as a prophet here. That's not how the apostle, like John, the disciple John, is like portrayed, exactly in the other Gospels. The letters of John, they have this as a part of it, right? There's this kind of confrontation in the community that's happening in 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. But at the same time, there's just it seems pretty different. So the language itself is the number one difference. The Gospel of John is written in beautiful Greek, but Revelation is not. So in any event, as I said, Rome is the main enemy. As I pointed out before, Nero shows up in this book. By the way, the 666, right, the kind of numbers of the kind of the beast, 666 and then 616, both are kind of mentioned. These are perhaps referring to alternate ways to spell the name Nero or Neron, the name of the emperor in Greek. So the emperor Nero is here, but it's a lot of the book is also about Nero kind of like coming back from the grave and like getting the people. So this is a part of probably a prophecy called Nero Redivivus, or Nero living again, Nero coming back from the grave. So right around the year 100, there were a bunch of people, Christians, who were really worried about Nero coming back from the grave to try to persecute Christians more, right? So Nero's kind of rebirth or reanimation as a supervillain for Christians seems to be something that actually postdates Nero himself. But there's also a mention of the seven mountains of Rome in chapter 17, verse 9. Rome was famously founded on seven mountains and so on. Near the Tiber River. This was a big part of its identity. It calls itself the City of Seven Hills. And why would I need to even worry about this? It's because Rome is not actually mentioned in the book of Revelation. It's Babylon that's the major enemy, but Babylon was from a long time ago, right? So it's kind of written in this code. Remember we said, I said just earlier in the presentation about apocalyptic literature, that kind of code and secret language and hidden secrets is a big part of this literature and this genre. So why is Rome such an enemy here? Probably because near the time of Emperor Domitian, probably not part of his like imperial rule, he didn't issue an edict or anything like this, that all Christians need to be persecuted. There seems to have been sporadic, local persecution of Christians in Asia Minor, also some in North Africa, by probably local officials, and maybe some Roman governors got pulled into this. And it's possible that Domitian had to kind of say yes or no to some things. But this seems to not have been part of his actual imperial rule. But right around that time, the Roman Empire, via their local governance, sponsored some persecution of Christians. People, this probably has to do with kind of the strange nature of Christianity. That is to say, the religion itself doesn't seem to have kind of a homeland like Judaism does. If people said, well, I'm not really a Jew, but I'm following the Jewish God, also it means that I don't want to do particular things like serve the emperors and worship the emperors, which everyone is doing in Asia Minor. It's a big part of the culture in Asia Minor is to worship the emperors. So if you say I don't do that kind of stuff, it's worse than just kind of being a party pooper. It really means that you are like an enemy of the state. So these Christians are saying, well, I'm an enemy of the state because I go to a secret meeting that no one else is allowed to, where we drown people symbolically, but we drown people in baptism, and then they're born again after they died, so they're kind of zombies, and then we eat flesh together at this love feast. They called, right, the Eucharist was called the agape meal, the love feast. We have letters from early Roman leaders with it to talk about how these Christians are cannibals. They're atheists because they say the gods don't exist. They meet together for this love feast. Of course, they're talking about orgies. They are eating people's blood, and they're killing people, and they're drowning them and then eating them. I mean, they came up with all these crazy ideas because Christians were kind of secretive about what they were all about. All to say, this leads to some local officials saying that these Christians are worthless, right? And probably are enemies of the state and need to be. So the Romans were really worried about revolt and would even put down, didn't allow like volunteer firefighter units to form, so because they were worried about them fomenting discord. So all to say, the persecution of Christians was part and parcel of what the Roman Empire did in general. So here's just a little example of Roman ideology. So the Roman Empire, like every empire, has tried to express its ideas and its founding mythology and its concept of the world and promulgate it through propaganda, right? Every empire in the history of the world has done this. Propaganda takes visual form. It takes kind of written form, oral form, liturgical form, like doing ceremonies and things like this. And these symbols are meant to kind of like be soft power, right? Broadcast the ideas about the Roman Empire, what it wants throughout the world, because it's a lot cheaper than making an army go everywhere and force people into compliance, right? But also because you try to get subtly into people's minds, and if you can get everybody's mind to start playing your own record about what the world is like and who they are and, you know, who's really important in the world and what their place in the world is and so on, you can get people to be really compliant. So this is the Gemma Augustea. It's a little cameo gem that was worn to promote Emperor Augustus sometime in the first century, probably after Augustus's death. But you can see up here, there's two registers, a top register and a lower register. This is Roman Empire propaganda in a nutshell. You can find this kind of propaganda everywhere in the Roman Empire, but I just like this picture because it's so clear. So on the top level, here is Augustus Caesar sitting, looking like Zeus or Jupiter, right? The high god. And he's kind of sitting there shirtless, right? He's being crowned by the economy herself, the goddess Oikonomia, or the household. So the goddess of, like, kind of the structure of the Roman Empire, figured as kind of the household itself, right? Like the emperor is the dad, and we're all the kids to varying degrees. So here's the economy crowning Augustus, and he's got Jupiter's eagle underneath him to show us that he's really Jupiter, right? He's really the high god. Here's Roma, the goddess embodying Rome herself, that is sitting next to him as he gets crowned. He's getting crowned with a thorn, with a oak leaf crown, which is the crown of a savior, a soter. A savior is someone who saved the lives of many Roman citizens. How did he save the lives of Roman citizens? By creating the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. He ended civil wars in Rome, resulting from Julius Caesar's assassination, but also kind of created this kind of structure of peace around the world. That peace meant, and here's all their gods and goddesses kind of joining in, right? For this kind of peace and structure to reign, here's what has to happen underneath. So literally supporting in this gem, all of this amazing stuff happening up here in this kind of a world of harmony and peace and prosperity, supporting that is the Roman Empire's army. Here's the Roman Empire's soldiers that are lifting up a trophy, which they would take a Roman armor and put it on a big stick and a stake and heave it up to signify a victory. And here's the barbarian peoples, probably the Gauls or something like this, the Celtic people of the barbarians of Europe, who are being taken away as slaves. The woman here is dejected and downcast and defeated. A man over here is bound, right, his arms tied behind his back, looking on in anger and rage at Rome, signifying its victory. Over here we have Diana, the goddess of the hunt, who is helping them fight. And here we have Mercury, right, the messenger god, with his little hat here. They're dragging barbarians along with them, right, in order to subjugate them to the empire. They're sparing their lives, right? So this is seen as mercy. They're not killing them, but they're just going to take them as slaves. So this is the Pax Romana. You want to fight us? We're going to kill you. We might make you slaves. That would be really nice of us, right? But we dominate the world, and that's how we make peace, right? So this is Roman symbolism right here. The victor, the trophy, the savior, right? The economy, the household, right? So all these things are symbolically important. And the Book of Revelation functions kind of like a political cartoon. A lot of the crazy symbols that we see in Revelation are actually inversions of some of these things that we find, these symbols that we find throughout the Roman world, as a way to say that God's kingdom is the inverse of the kingdom that Rome talks about. The peace of Christ is the inversion of the peace of Rome. The victory of Christ is the inversion of the victory of Rome. The way that Christ relates to the nations, the ends of the earth, is the opposite of the way that the Roman Empire is relating to the nations and the ends of the earth and so on. So all to say, this is, if you read the Book of Revelation that way, with that lens, it really helps. Like I said, I'm going to move myself down a little bit so you can see. The Book of Revelation is, in a way, an inversion of or a challenge to Rome's strategy to pacify the subjected peoples of its empire. which Rome would, of course, show up. There's a famous scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, which is a funny movie, and there's a scene in it where there's a sort of a group of kind of proto-Marxist Palestinian activists who are meeting together during the time of the Roman Empire, and one of them says, okay, let's get these Romans out of here. What did the Romans ever do for us? And then, you know, the other activists kind of sit there for a minute and think, well, they did build those roads, and they built the aqueducts, and they did build the schools, and, well, you know, they have brought a lot of trade to our area. You know, they keep on going on about how amazing, what amazing things Rome has brought to them, right? Well, we can see up here, this is a little image of Rome, but we got the Colosseum, right, the games, we have the temples, this amazing architecture that ancient Rome would have built. We have the baths and the aqueducts that follow the bath, like the line of the baths. We have the hippodrome, like these racing arenas. We have the forums and the places of the marketplaces where people would have met. I mean, all these things would have been really amazing to so many people around the Mediterranean basin and the Near East at the time of Rome, right? So you become part of the Roman Empire, and all of a sudden, like, Rome's building all this really cool stuff. You have access to all these neat things. You have access to all this education, all this trade, all these trading routes, all these roads that are protected by Roman soldiers and things. I mean, it would have been striking. So there was a lot of temptation for people to sell out and join the Roman Empire and be happy, placated citizens, right? Of course, a lot of this is founded on their own abuse, they're being taken advantage of. They have been violently subjugated, and they don't get a choice in most of the things that happened. But they get bread and circuses, right? So this is in many ways the kind of argument that's taking place in a lot of small local communities in response to the Roman Empire's rise. So in Jerusalem, this is the same thing, right? But also in the Jewish and Christian communities throughout the Mediterranean basin. So about this problem, this tension, right? The Roman orator, the first century, this guy's lived around the same time as Jesus, and really, I mean, really, you can think of him as like a contemporary of Paul. So this Roman orator, Tacitus, he wrote indigenous people of different areas that were dominated by the Roman Empire. The people were seduced into alluring vices, pillared halls, like, you know, beautiful architectural spaces. Baths and choice banquets. The simple natives gave the name culture to this aspect of their slavery. It's actually a really interesting point being made, right? So, like, the barbarians, right? So, like, the Germanic tribes that pacify themselves, right? Stop fighting against the Romans, at least for a couple centuries, and accept things like nice architecture and so on, but also pay a lot of taxes to Rome, and they become basically Roman citizens. And in a way, it's like a sleight of hand, right? They don't notice much of their subjugation, in part because they have, like, neat stuff that they're getting in return for it. I imagine that the Book of Revelation is written with this in mind. So this is the reason why Rome is depicted as the whore of Babylon. It is depicted as, like, as I've talked about before, in a covenant-based community. Israel is a covenant-based community. Unlike other ancient Eastern peoples, Israel thinks of its relationship to God as a covenant, a deal that's been brokered, or a marriage was a covenant in the ancient world. It was more like a deal than it was kind of like falling in love. All to say that the kind of somebody who cheats on someone else, who's unfaithful to their marriage covenant, was a metaphor for when Israel or when the Jews would follow in some other god and worship some other god, right? To betray the uniqueness of the God of Israel. So who is a jealous God, right? That's why, you know, God is a jealous God. That's this kind of strange thing to say, right? But in the ancient world, there were lots of gods, and no gods were jealous, right? I mean, Zeus didn't care if you worshipped Diana too, right? Or Zeus didn't care if you worshipped, Apollo, right? I mean, of course you're going to worship Apollo and Zeus, right? They're both awesome gods. The God of Israel demanded loyalty, unique loyalty. You're not going to worship any of these other gods. That was a really strange thing to say in the ancient world. It's partly why Jews and Christians never were quite understood by the Roman Empire, why they kept getting into trouble, because the Romans never quite understood this aspect, the uniqueness of worship. That's why you can't worship the emperor and so on. In any event, the uniqueness of the relationship was often pictured as a marriage relationship. Because like the uniqueness of a marriage relationship, right? If you just start sleeping with people, you're breaking that relationship. That is a metaphor that was used in ancient Israel to try to get people to understand that, like, to worship another god is to cheat, right? Is to commit adultery and so on. This can be abused in so many ways in the Old Testament. So the book of Hosea is beautiful in some ways. It's also really hard to read in some ways. It's also really hard to speak about and teach people especially people who have suffered abuse, because you read the portrait of God in Hosea and it's that God is kind of a spurned lover that then like gets angry and threatens violence. So there's some issues of gender that you can see here in Revelation 2. So the whore of Babylon, all the whorings of Babylon. I mean, this is drawing from the language of Hosea because it's trying to say that when you worship the emperor or you worship the Roman Empire, what you're doing is you're selling out, you're cheating on God, the God of Israel, who demands unique allegiance through Jesus. And that's in the book of Revelation, right? It's coming from a Jesus-following community where Jesus is the way that you get to and worship God the Father. So all to say that Babylon is pictured as this kind of whoremonger. It is interesting to see too, and it's important note just about Revelation and gender, that like in the book of Revelation is clearly written by a man to men, because women appear in the book, but they appear primarily as kind of like objects of male attention or anger. So there's like the beautiful woman clothed in a robe. There's also the whore of Babylon. Those are the two pictures of women, perfect or whore, right? And so just to point out that throughout history, these have been interpreted in ways that have made women's lives pretty untenable, right? You have two choices, perfect or whore. Perfect or totally evil. So, you know, that's how the whore of Babylon is depicted in this text, right? We can interpret this in better ways. There are some recent feminist theologians and scholars like Catherine Keller who have pointed out that there's actually some really interesting gender, like kind of proto-feminist ways to read the book of Revelation in terms of gender as well. So it's an open conversation, but just to say that's something to keep in mind here when we talk about the whore of Babylon a lot. So when we read the book of Revelation, we can see that the purpose of the book seems to be to encourage resistance against Rome from Christians. So don't assimilate to the Roman Empire. Don't accommodate them. Instead, see yourself as opposed to them. Don't follow Romans 13, right? Don't follow 1 Peter. Don't call yourself a good citizen of Rome. Here's a different vision of reality. A counter to Rome's mythology and symbolism, the story that they tell people about how the world works. Instead of the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, where everyone shuts up and quiets down and accepts their bread and circuses and in return doesn't rebel against Rome, instead we have the peace of Christ, which liberates people for heavenly worship, which in some ways tears down the unequal distribution of power in the world, tries to get rid of kind of oppressive violence that has tormented Christians and other people throughout the Roman Empire and so on, and liberating the peoples of the different parts of the empire to sing in their own language and tongues and so on and worship in their own language, which sounds a lot like Isaiah chapter 2, which sounds a lot like some of the things that Paul says about the end and so on. So it's a neat, in that way, an inversion of what Rome's peace is imagined to be. Instead of just like get wealthy by shutting up and listening to Rome, instead this is a very different depiction of community and what the purpose of life is. In contradistinction to Victoria, the kind of imperial conquest of Rome, the victory, right, raising the triumph, which means you have to debase others, you have to demean others, you have to destroy others, you have to take away their sense of uniqueness and so on. I mean, Rome loved these images of Gauls committing suicide because they had lost, you know, it's kind of like valiantly honoring them, but also at the same time, like kind of getting some sick pleasure out of the fact that you made these brave people commit suicide. Instead of that kind of victory, that imperial conquest that demolishes all and so on, you get this other kind of victory where it's a lamb. It's a lamb who is slain, who is the centerpiece, who is the victory, right? The victory is the one who is slain. The martyrs, the people who gave up their lives in order to defend and simply not go along with the empire, those are the people who are lifted up as triumphal in the end, right? And not triumphal because they have slaughtered Rome, but triumphal because they actually gave up their lives, laid their lives down. And so the kind of giving of life, the giving of, the kind of humble acceptance That even though the way the world isn't the way things should be, that it's not necessarily on us right now to make things right, but that we have to accept that God's going to work in God's time. That's a very different way of thinking about victory, right? But it's this victorious Lamb who was slain, who is being acclaimed here. And you got to think about a Revelation as being kind of performed, sung, chanted aloud, being read by someone kind of actively. You know, this was not written for personal written consumption and so on. So kind of in this community, you can imagine people getting really excited, you know, and cheering along. The idea of faith, right? Putting your faith in the Roman Empire. Believing that Rome's going to give you the things that you need, that Rome's going to last forever. Roma Aeterna, this really fundamental idea of an ancient Roman ideology, that Rome was going to last forever. It was never going to go away. This is, you know, kind of follows, you know, Christians adopt this imagery too, which is partly why the idea that, I mean, the Moscow calls itself the Third Rome, because the first Rome falls, right? But then the Constantinople is the Second Rome, and then Constantinople falls in 1453, and Moscow begins calling itself the Third Rome because Rome didn't fall. You know, it's this really interesting idea, but it's drawn from Roman ideology. But there's a very different idea in Revelation, that it's not Rome that's the eternal kingdom or the eternal city, but it's actually Jerusalem at the end, right? The new Jerusalem is the eternal city. And then you get this kind of beautiful image at the end of the book. So just to talk about like kind of the structure of the book. I mean, you have the letters and the kind of prophetic letters to the seven churches of Revelation in chapters 1 through 3. In 4 and 5, you have the visions of the Lamb and the throne. And then you have the scrolls that are unrolled in chapters 6 and 7. And then kind of going on through to chapter 12, this kind of a vision of these kind of unfolding seven scrolls. And then you switch in chapter 12 and you have this kind of fight between the archangel Michael and kind of the devil, you know, pictured as a beast coming from the sea, drawing from Daniel 7, and then the woman clothed with the sun, who is, of course, you know, pictured as Mary, and that gives birth to the Christ. And so this is what leads to the downfall of the beast. But then you have the kind of the seven bowls and so on. So this it's kind of it's like the story's told again and again, that there's these kind of seven things that lead to seven things lead to seven things. There's kind of three sevens that occur. But this the seven scrolls, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. But all of them are repeating the same story, which is that there's going to be calamity, and then that Christ will rule, and the Christ will save. So Babylon kind of finally falls in chapter 18, and then you get the thousand-year thing, which is where you get this idea that there's going to be a millennium, like the millennials, right? Not the generation, but post-millennial Christians or pre-millennial Christians, like that whole conversation there is about chapter 20 of Revelation, and where does this thousand years fall? It seems symbolic to me, but you know, I don't think there's... all of Revelation seems to be very symbolic. I don't think that there's any way that we can take these particular verses and kind of pin them to some sort of hope that it's going to really look like this in the end. You can try to play that game, but I'm definitely not going to. But all to say that in the end, there's the new heaven, new earth, the new Jerusalem. And instead of it being like the old earth that's thrown away, it's that there was a new heaven and new earth that kind of gets like refounded. It's Jerusalem again, right? It's like a renewal. The first heaven and first earth go away, but it's this earth that is renewed and restored. And that's the new earth. It's Jerusalem still, right? It's a new Jerusalem. So it sounds a lot like the end of the book of Ezekiel, chapters 43-48, where Jerusalem gets kind of restored and so on. And at the very end, it's Christ who says, in chapter 22, verse 13, I am the Alpha and Omega, the first and last, the beginning and the end. So there is our beginning and end of the book. So in any event, this is meant to be kind of the beginning and end, the Roma Aeterna, right? That Jesus is actually the one, Christ is actually the one who is the beginning and the end, not Rome. And that Christ's city is, funny enough, Jerusalem, right? I mean, it's Jesus didn't have a great time in Jerusalem, it seems, according to the Gospels. But nonetheless, but Jesus did have a love and a passion for the way that Jerusalem existed as kind of a symbol, and in the way that the way that it could be a place of interacting and relating to God. So just to say that this kind of persecution of Christians and the shame of kind of the Christians and the cross and all that strange stuff, we have historical evidence that this is true. This is the Alexamenos Graffito. in Rome, actually right next to the Forum. If you've ever been to Rome, the Campidoglio is this beautiful plaza designed by Michelangelo on one of the seven hills of Rome. And it looks out, the rear of it, the back of it, looks out over the Forum, the real main Forum in Rome. And near there, right next to the Forum, was this, it was a barracks for soldiers. And sometime around, like not long after the time of Jesus, we have this graffito. Somebody took a nail and wrote, drew this picture, and that's the real thing above. But over there, you can see the line drawing. Someone, you know, it's drawn it out so it's easier to see. And there's a ass-headed man with someone saying, you know, hi, whatever. But this is the sign for worship or praise. So someone's adoring an ass-headed, crucified God. And it says underneath it, Alexamenos, this guy's name's Alex, worships God. And the theon at the bottom there. Alexamenos sebete theon. And so, like, you know, this guy, Alexamenos, Alex worships God, this ass-headed God. So it was mocked that people would worship a crucified God. That was a bizarre and strange idea, one that would have been mocked. But also this idea, you can see it mocked here, that someone would imagine victory a different way. I mean, the crucifixion was a punishment for seditious criminals in the Roman Empire. It was meant to torture people in order to humiliate them. You worship a humiliated, ass-headed God. So, again, you can see this, this is a sore spot for Christians. You know, they're teased about this, quite literally. But also that this was something that the Romans recognized in Christianity. However, didn't understand it, but just made fun of it. You worship the Lamb that was slain. Or the donkey, the ass that was slain, you know, according to this picture. And just to say, this is the kind of motivating rhetoric of Revelation. Yes, we do, and that's where all God's power comes from. It's this huge inversion and surprise that will one day be revealed or apocalypsed. So, in any event, all to say, I wouldn't suggest using Revelation as a map for the end times. If you start to see some crazy earthquakes and things happening, I wouldn't pull the book of Revelation out to help us understand that. Instead, if you go through enormous trials and you are oppressed, if you are part of a community that has been dominated by a much stronger community and you ask the question, where is God in all this? Why is God allowing this to happen? I thought God was supposed to lead us to victory or protect us or save us. What could possibly be happening in this time of crisis? Revelation is then somewhere to go, not to tell you exactly what's going to happen in the future, but instead to tell us what God is doing right now. The crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus has already happened. It's all around us. It's with us. This victory has already happened. Whatever is going to happen in the end is going to be something that has already happened. That is the victory of Christ, won through the cross and through death and through resurrection itself. Okay, so I know I didn't go too much into detail on the visions, but hopefully that's enough of an overview that you can go back and kind of use some study notes and get into it. But just to remind us, we began this semester by asking the question, what is the New Testament? I hope we've got some idea of that by now, but we have gone through some different categories of literature. I'm going to move my big face right here, we can see we've got four major categories of literature here. The Gospels, so we talked about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We talked about the strange, you know, genre of Acts. It's like a sequel to a gospel that is after the person has died and been resurrected and has ascended into heaven, and then the church is trying to figure out how to act like Jesus or live like Jesus. So it's a strange category all to itself. But then we have the letters, which dominate in terms of the number of books, dominate the New Testament. So the Gospels, we have Acts, we have the letters of Paul, also the Catholic letters, or the general epistles, the general letters, Hebrews through Jude, which includes the letters of John that I didn't have time to talk about today, but hopefully you can see how they interact in terms of themes with both the Gospel of John and with Revelation. And then lastly, we have the apocalyptic book, which is just Revelation. There's apocalyptic stuff all throughout the Gospels, all throughout Paul's letters. If you look at Mark 13, that's an apocalyptic chapter. But much of Mark is not clearly apocalyptic, right? It's all influenced by it, but it's not an apocalypse as a literary genre, right? we could call Mark 13 like a little apocalypse, but it misses a lot of the things that are important in terms of like the genre, the type of literature, the apocalypse. So all to say, this is the New Testament. This is what we got. This is what we got to work with. I am, you know, sorry to come to the end here. Remember that if you want to, in 2 weeks, you can join Office Hours Bible Study to talk about the book of Job, or spend 5 weeks talking about Job. We'll do something else after that. So throughout the summer, hopefully we have some adult education content. We'll see what happens in the future in terms of opening churches and meeting together and studying together. But I'll look forward, dear folks of Marietta, one day to getting back together with you soon. If you have suggestions about what we should study next, let me know. I've fielded a bunch of different ideas. One idea is kind of important questions of the Bible. So to deal with kind of sticky issues, like tricky issues, right? So that's one thing. Another idea that someone threw out was kind of the history of the church. You know, just start, okay, we went through the New Testament. Let's keep going. Let's look at some of the apostolic fathers or mothers and fathers of the church and see what they were doing. That's an interesting topic. So there's lots of other things we can do, but let me know what you're thinking, and look forward to seeing y'all again sometime soon. Peace.
This podcast is a ministry of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta. Come join us Sundays at 189 Church Street, Marietta, Georgia, or visit us online at fpcmarietta.org.